Welcome to the Ethics Experts, where we're elevating ethics and compliance and HR to the strategic level it's supposed to be.
Hey, this is the Ethics Experts. If it's your first time joining us, welcome. And if you're a returning subscriber, hello, friend. Hope you're having an amazing day. See what happens when you subscribe to the Ethics Experts. You get a bonus greeting on every single episode. So no brainer to hit that subscribe button. We got a real treat today. I'm here with my friend, Simon Fowler. He is a behavior change expert. He's a guy who we're gonna have a real interesting conversation. He's got some really interesting background and some real interesting perspective about behavior change. And super excited to get you on, man. How's it going?
Good. Good to see you, Nick.
Yeah, good to see you too. So let's just dive right in. I think when we first connected, we spent a lot of time talking about relationships and why they matter, both on an intrinsic and an extrinsic basis. And that's not something that I kind of thought about, those two different sort of sides of that fence. Tell us a little bit about that model and, you know, why they matter on both of those sides.
Yeah, so relationships matter because it's fundamental to being human that we are in relationship. People, even animals, literally die if they're not in contact. And so there's something intrinsic to our nature that that requires relationship, which is essentially a series of interactions that has a past and has a future, not just a one-off meeting, but something that has a past and a future. So intrinsically, we're just made for a relationship with each other. And extrinsic may not be the right word, but basically to get things done, you know, corporeal body, it's got parts that interconnect and together things get done. And if those relationships are disconnected, then it's harder to get things done, or you'll just do things badly, or it'll take a long time. So that's what I mean, intrinsic and extrinsic.
So, we kind of moved from that to talking about this relationship proximity framework. Tell us how that whole thing works and what these different components of them are, because I think we gloss over some of the sort of more, I don't know, complex nuances in relationship. And we as leaders in our organization end up leaving a lot of, you know, money on the table, to use a gambling analogy. We leave a lot of money on the table because we're not using these relationships or taking advantage of them, or really kind of giving the right care to them.
Yes. So, yes, exactly. So I guess one critique that I have about most relationship talk is that people think about it in terms of the individual and one's relationship quotient or relational capabilities or emotional intelligence. So something inherent to the individual and their abilities. That's commonly how relationships are thought about. And if you're getting relationship training, it's you kind of getting better at reading relationships. Relational proximity is a framework that history. I came across it 30 years ago, 1993, in a book called The R Factor by David Lee and Michael Sluter. And it was essentially a book around public policy. And when you're building a hospital or a prison, are you thinking about the relationships of the people involved? So it might be more efficient to put a hospital 50 miles from six nearest cities, but 50 miles. Nurses, doctors have to travel from where their cities are to there, or people caring for their patients. So literally thinking about how things are built and where things are built and the human beings involved in them and the impact of that on relationships. So that's where the book came from, and it posited five domains of relationship. So essentially it's not exhaustive list, but it's five factors of any relationship that are just there. And I don't think most people would argue with them. So there's contact. You need some meaning of contact, otherwise you don't have a relationship. Time, so like I said, it's not a one-off encounter. Knowledge, there's some sense of understanding and mutual knowledge. There's a human relationship, you kind of know something about each other. Power, there's influence on each other. There's a sort of neglect or exploitation or just influence, positive and wonderful. that power. And then there's purpose. You know, why does the relationship exist? If I've got limited time, who do I spend my time with? What relationships do I have? And why do I even have them? What's the friendship for? What's the marriage for? So those are the five domains of relationship. And each of those have drivers for proximity. And proximity essentially, generally speaking, you'd say relationships are going to be better if you have more. Actually, in a lot of cases, it's got to be less. And that's exactly the point of thinking about relationships and those five domains, is that in a dyadic relationship, two people or two organizations or two groups, their perspective on those things is going to be different. It doesn't matter if they're an extrovert or an introvert, how much contact I have, how direct the relationship is. So in the domain of contact, directness. How much directness is appropriate? The marriage is going to be very different from your neighbor in terms of contact. Now, different contexts even, that's going to be different. But if one person thinks face-to-face contact is really important, and the other person doesn't, then there's one person thinks this person is neglecting me. The other person is feeling a bit creeped out because this person just wants to be in my space, and I don't want them in my space. So just a simple matter of, like, how do you contact each other and the different perspective on it can create all sorts of challenges. With time, you've got continuity. How much time over time? How often do we meet? You and I have met before, kind of briefly. We've texted, we've connected on LinkedIn, and we've spoken. We have met in person, and maybe we won't again, and that's fine for our relationship. We'll hopefully meet each other again. But your expectation of how much time this relationship has, how much you want from me and the medium of our communication is different. And again, if you don't show up, or I don't show up enough or whatever, then that causes problems. So do you want me to go on to the other three?
Please go now. No, because I'm learning so much here, and I'm thinking about some new relationships that I've started to establish in my own life, and how some pain points have started to kind of creep up, whether they're driven by my own insecurities, or like, does this person actually like me, or is it just a mismatch on some of this proximity, or, you know, it's just an expectations mismatch. And it sometimes takes a little kind of time to, I don't know, feel those things out, which gets more difficult. And when you're at different stages of life and so forth. So please, by all means, keep going. Yeah. This is very interesting.
It gets very practical. If you've got a lot of relational responsibilities in your work and your home, then you've literally only got so much time you can give.
Right.
And if you're going to meet people and encounter them, face-to-face encounter, you can only do so much of that. And so a new person comes into your life. Now, ideally, you just fold them into your current relationships. But if you're going to just see them, you've got to not see other people. So you've got to make some decisions about which relationships are important to me. And I can't be everybody's friend, or I want more friends. So just in terms of contact and time, this becomes very, very practical about how do you talk to people. And we avoid talking about the relationships. And we avoid saying, listen, I can't give her any more time. So I take care of my mother-in-law. She lives with us. She's 92, and she needs 24-hour care. And my wife's an only child. There's only so much thing I'm going to do. I've got two young teenage daughters. I want to be home. So as much as I love you, Nick, I'm not going to travel to see you. Anyway, so that's just on two factors.
It's not me, it's you.
it's not even you. It's not even you. It's these other things. Yeah.
Totally. Yeah.
Yeah.
But if you don't talk about it, and you don't have the terms to talk about it, or we don't have the language for it or something, it can lead to a lot of like unintended offenses. And I mean, I'm, you know, there's probably bodies in the wake of my ship of life from stuff like this, where I've burned a bridge and not even known it, or, you know what I'm saying? Because there was that expectations mismatch in the context of a relationship as it's progressed and as there's been new demands on my time or their time or whatever, you know? I mean, it's a very interesting framework.
Yeah, exactly. And like I say, more generally relationships are going to be better if there's more of this, more contact. But sometimes you just can't give it, or sometimes it's just not appropriate. Actually, if our dynamics, you're going to want to be careful about how direct you get with people. And as you say, the honest conversation means that people get unnecessarily offended, but sometimes you just got to offend people because they want more than you can give, and that becomes their problem. But at least you can communicate, listen, I have other priorities right now. That's all I can do.
So talk to me about multiplexity. That's not a word or a term I'm that familiar with. And how does that map to these other sort of pillars of this proximity framework?
Yeah. So another aspect of a relationship is the degree to which each party knows each other and understands each other's motives and challenges. So if I don't know what your responsibilities are, what your skills and interests and challenges are, and you don't know mine, then what we expect of each other, even going back to time and contact, is going to be distorted. We'll misunderstand each other. And it might mean, and so that's a multiplexity basically means many sidedness.
Okay.
So if we only ever, like, interestingly enough, you and I having a conversation, we'll know more about each other than some of the people I've worked with for years. Because the sliver of life that we engage with each other in is just about work.
Right.
So now I'm a pretty open person. So most people know that I, you know, about my family, my mother-in-law. But most of the time, you can just carry on and you just don't know what the other people are carrying. And in the business context, you either don't know what their skills are, so you sort of misunderstand what they can contribute, or you don't know what their challenges are or what their own priorities are. And you come in with all these expectations, thinking that they should be about you. But they've got this other world. A colleague's had a death in the family just recently. I had no idea. And they're not getting back to me, and I'm just kind of getting a little annoyed about it.
Right.
They had a death in the family. Now, it could be the work that the company needs to maybe work out as a process so that things don't get dropped. But anyway, my point is that your knowledge of each other and the many-sidedness of each other builds understanding. I can understand why you're putting in the effort you are, or why you're not putting in the effort you are, or why you're going to turn up, or what you've got to contribute. So knowledge and multiplexity. And one of the things, a rule in any relationship, if you interact in two or three contexts rather than one, the relationship is going to be so much healthier. You literally go out for lunch once, or you do some other thing, like go to a sports game or do a service activity together. You don't have to sort of get deep with each other and just talk deeply. Just do something different. And you say, holy cow, that person who is really shy in the office talking about technology, they're like bold as anything with the homeless, or with, their sensitivity to people is just extraordinary. But you just wouldn't discover it unless you just did something else.
So funny. Our company's been growing a lot, and we recently had like a big hiring. And because of that, we all went out, we all went out together, and we had like a night out and, got drinks and hung out and played some games at this bar restaurant that had a bunch of stuff. And like, to your point, it feels like those people just like rocketed forward because I felt like I understood. You know, you're kind of like articulating kind of like whatever the magic was. It's like, well, wow, why did that sort of offsite work so well? And it's like, well, because we got to do some things that were not work things. You got to kind of know what that person was actually like in a different setting, when they're not all buttoned up and wearing that like bizarre work facade that we all seem to put on, especially when you first start a new job, you know what I'm saying? But that, you know, multiplexity, or that multi-sidedness, as you called it, is so critical. And, you know, And in geometry, right, a point is a point, 2 points make a line, 3 points make a plane. If you have three of these things, you're adding a new level of dimensionality to this person. Yeah. And it's very easy to, you know, to your point, be like, oh, this guy's a jerk. And how bizarre is it that we always, well, I'll speak for myself, I guess, but I don't think I'm that unique in this. We always tend to, like, you never have all the information, right? A person, to the extent they're like a multivariable, you know, a multivariable equation or sort of a multi-factor equation, and you only know one or two of the variables, you're going to fill in some assumptions for these other variables, and they're rarely accurate. And they're usually like tilted to the negative. To your point, you're getting annoyed with this guy who like didn't respond to the email, and the guy's weeping over his dad's casket or something. You know what I'm saying? It's like, ooh.
Yeah.
So just taking that time to open it up and have a conversation, or to your point, go to lunch or something, it'll pay dividends going forward. But it's like, we don't have time to do it for some reason.
Yeah, exactly. Those great analogies, actually. But that's exactly it. And it actually leads to the fourth dimension, which is around power. So the driver of proximity is parity. There's parity in the relationship. It doesn't mean everyone's got the same power. So I'm 6'2". My daughter is getting very tall now, but she's shorter than me. So I've got physical power. That is the reality of an aspect of our relationship. But how is that power used? Is it used fairly and respectfully?
Right.
It's such a huge part of every relationship, and again it can, so many very innocent things. Nobody's sort of trying to be mean or horrible, but part of a relationship is the ability to participate in it. And somebody, in all being unselfish, doesn't want to bother the person, so they don't give them anything to do,
right?
And they're full of gifts, that i.e. which you don't know about because you haven't got to know them and the knowledge, and they want to be part of the relationship. You know, any relationship, you kind of want to contribute to it and participate. But one person thinks, I'll do it. You're actually disrespecting them. On the other hand,
totally,
if they don't want to contribute, you could be pulling things out of them, which is exploitation, which is another use of your power, but it's in the other direction. One is just that you're not letting their power, quote unquote, their influence to affect you. On the other side, you're using yours to exploit them. Right. But exploit is a strong word, but it could be very simply like you're doing a project together and you're demanding a lot from people and they don't want to be demanded of.
Right.
But they don't get any reward. Like in the business context, you're getting people to help you, you get the bonus. And it's not shared with them. And so they may have contributed, actually, and maybe even felt good about what they're doing, but then one person gets the reward. So there's a dynamic in the power or the parity thing about participation or neglect. And there's another one is about, is there a fair reward for the effort that they're putting in? That's another aspect of power. And going back to the multiplexity thing, you do something else together, you get to realize what the person is able to do. You get to see what their strengths are, and you get to, you know, I'm a Christian, and I've used this analogy before, like, you know, Bible study. Somebody may be a little brainiac around the Bible, so they're all waxing eloquent theology, and then there's other people who are just like, I can barely work out the second commandment, how do I love people? And so in that domain, the brainiac just feels like dominating, and they feel like so full of confidence. Then they go out and they go and serve the homeless. And then the brainiac is just like all completely terrified. They have no idea what to do practically. But the person who didn't say a peep is full of courage and tenderness, and like, and so interacting in different domains, you start to see fairness or sort of power balances way out. You're strong in this context, I'm strong in that context, you help me here, I help you there. And over time, again, it's sort of relationship takes time, and you interact in different instances, and you start to see this parity sort of bear out. It's rarely going to happen in one instance.
You know, what's interesting is that in our own body, we have the same thing that you're talking about, because the ear is not the eye and the hand is not the foot, and all these things work together to achieve some good or achieve some purpose, but they all have their own purpose.
Right.
And you have to be in these different realms to see these different things. And to your point, if you're just seeing somebody at Bible study or just seeing them at the soup kitchen, you won't even know what they're really great at.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Which leads to the fifth one in some ways, with purpose. So it's another, why does the relationship even exist? And if there's no common, there's no commonality of purpose, or the driver of proximity is that there's commonality, you've got a shared understanding about why does this relationship exist? What's it for, and how important is it? Mm-hmm. If you've got differences of opinion about that, then you'll misunderstand why did they not turn up?
Totally.
This is like critical. It's not to them. You didn't even find out if they wanted to be part of it. So all these other aspects that seem like that you're now attributing negative intent or negative motive is simply mm-hmm. because, listen, I've got a 92-year-old mother-in-law who I need to feed. So I'm not going to be there every week. I'm sorry. I'm not going to be there every day.
Can't love ya, but I love her more. Or, you know, this is great. Yeah. This is fun to hang out, but I have another priority that's bigger, that has, you know, it's a bigger priority, or it's higher up on my hierarchy of, you know, purpose or whatever. You know what I'm saying?
Which comes back to the multiplexity thing. It's just that if you understand what people's other issues and challenges and priorities are, you're going to have less expectation for what they can contribute. So again, what they can contribute with power, how much time they're going to give to you, or how much they're going to put into traveling across the country to be there. All these things come out of, in one sense, like how important, what is this relationship for? How important is to me? How important is it to me relative to all the other relationships that I have? The other thing I'll say about purpose, interestingly, is that it's also an emergent property from relationships. So it can be the reason why you have the relationship. I joined a company, I'm in a project, and that's why we're meeting. And so the purpose drives the interactions and my decisions about power and knowledge, and how much do I need to spend any time getting to know you. Or in my case, I've lived on the same street in Somerville, Massachusetts for 17 years. And my children have grown up with the children across the street, and we've been neighbors. And we, it sounds easy, but we call ourselves the Willowbites, and the name of the street. And although I don't know, tell the whole world where I live.
Yeah, give us your social after this. Go ahead.
Yeah, right. but because of the interactions over time, helping each other shovel snow, just saying, hey, good morning, you know, Truman Show, putting the garbage out. And then we've had yard sales. We have, you know, for years we've had an annual pumpkin carving. My father-in-law, he had Alzheimer's, he also lived at home with us, and he went missing one day, and all the neighbors came out searching for hours and hours and hours. And then another neighbor had a stroke, another neighbor had their son had a terrible accident at the growth plate when he was 10, and somebody died, somebody got married, babies were born, and a sense of community, a sense of like having a sense of like local identity has come out of these interactions over time, where we've seen, we've got to know each other because we've interacted in all these different contexts. We've given and received, sort of the power shift has changed in different circumstances and seasons. But it, what results in a sense of, this is family, man.
Right.
Because of contact and time and knowledge and parity of power and a sense of this is who we are. So purpose is I don't know, it's a much big increasing theme in business and at Korn Ferry, where I work in doing a lot of research on purpose. And it's key. It has huge influence on people's decisions around the relationships, among others.
Yeah, so what's surprising things came out of your research, or is coming out of your research on this purpose thing? And why is it now seeming to be more important than it was in our grandfather's generation or something?
Well, I have to confess, I haven't read the research yet. I didn't do the research, and they do a lot of research. So I don't know what it's saying. My speculation around why it is, partly, I think there's less sort of intrinsic loyalty to where people are working. I think partly it's a result of the fragmentation that's going on in society generally, that people are wanting to know what matters, what am I doing that means something? Am I really just a cog in the wheel? Am I just that sensible that I can just be sort of let go? And then, so I think companies are recognizing that people need a sense of purpose. I
think it's just the like transient nature of work, or the labor mobility coupled with I don't know. I mean, what else is it? You know, I mean, do you think it's just us moving from this more sort of industrial based work to more sort of knowledge based work coupled with some of these things, or?
Yeah, I think that's part of it. I think with postmodernism, you know, philosophically, there's less of a meta narrative that people are kind of working with. Sort of the big grand story that people had, whether it's theological or just
national or whatever.
Or just like having a job. It was a thing. I mean, you know, 100 years ago, how things have changed with work and the possibility of work and the length of life. There's so many things that I think used to be a sense of a sense of accomplishment to have a job or get a degree and then get a job and you stay in it for life was enough.
Yeah, it's like like an identity tied to it. You know, I'm a Standard Oil man. You know what I'm saying? Or I don't know. Like, you know, you do this one thing, and now it's like, well, you can be all these different things. And I wonder if that sort of meta narrative, or that it was really sort of like a foundational thing that had a little bit more stability or something, because that's gone, because we're now all these different things, and I can be a salesperson, and then I can be a doctor, and I can be a lawyer if I want to go back to school, or, you know, you can wear all these different like career hats that in the past you had to kind of just pick one. And stick with one, or you know, I don't know. That's pretty interesting.
Yeah, and so I think our narratives are getting smaller. They're not meta. They're just by what someone may want to say about the metaverse. But our narratives are getting smaller, and I think purpose is essentially what's the narrative that makes sense of my life. What is something that transcends me as an individual, but to which I contribute. So I think there's a longing for that sense of meaning, and meaning simply is surely the story that we're part of, not just our atomized living, doing things, and then dying. The existential thing is.
Yeah, like did a human being. Did Carnegie Steel have like a mission, vision, and values page? You know what I'm saying?
Right.
Like, did Standard Oil, like, I don't know, what's a massive, like, did the original JP Morgan Trading Co. or whatever, did they have a purpose statement? Or was it just like, well, we're in business, we're going to make money? You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. So, well, it actually makes me think that one of the changes is that postmodernism was a skepticism about the meta-narrative. And so what's there now is, like, you can take that mission statement, give me a break. It's just a logo.
Yeah.
Make it mean something to me. So I think that's where I suspect. I mean, I have kind of the research around purpose would go is people don't want it just to be this statement that, oh yeah, our company believes in blah blah blah. They want to see it played out in how the company operates. How does it remunerate? How does it reward? How does it recognize? How does it enable participation? So actually, I think the relational proximity model would be part of how the leaders think about people's participation. How do they bring their skills? How do they get rewarded for that? Does that feel fair? Does it feel part of a purpose that they individually and as a group feel like, yeah, no, I'm on board with this. And actually, it affects how I show up and whether I show up and when and whether I'm going to, you know, work late or get on. I hate being on camera. I'll get on the camera because I know that that's part of. So I think people want a purpose that goes beyond just the statement about it, but the warp and woof of their day-to-day living.
It's kind of interesting, right? Like there's this longing for a purpose that it goes beyond the words on the wall or the logo, as you said, the tagline underneath the logo. But how do you actually believe that purpose? You have to interact with it in some way, right?
Yeah.
And so if you're working in an office, then maybe you're feeling the vibe of the office, or you can see how people act when the chips are down and so forth. In this relatively sort of more fracture, I mean, we're talking about this like massive fracturing to just kind of draw this like high level picture that it was all, you know, we had this massive meta narrative at some point in the past, and now it's fractured out and it's become more fractalized even, which, you know, along with which has come this sort of increased desire to like fill in the gap with some kind of a purpose to kind of make, you know, how does my life have meaning? How does my work have meaning in the context of this organization that I'm a part of? Now, when you add on the fact that, like, I mean, there are people on our team that I've never met face to face. You know what I'm saying? Because of COVID, because of all this, like, you know, remote work thing. So, how do they participate in in the purpose? Like, how do they, like, how they're not in it? They're not, you know, I don't know. Do you know what I'm saying? Like,
yeah.
Like, how do you communicate it? You just say a bunch more words, or you have to, like, your opportunities to like prove it are diminished because you're not like face to face, or you can't feel the intensity when the chips are down or something. So it's like, it's working against each other. You know what I'm saying? It's like this desire is increasing, but then in this sort of like distributed workforce reality that we're all living in, it's like making it harder to make those nodes connect or something.
Yeah. Well, that brings, and before we won't have time to get into it, but it brings us to the Kanefin framework
last time. Perfect transition there. Supernatural, even.
Cynefin, Cynefin, a Welsh word meaning your place of multiple belongings or different domains, and it essentially posits ordered systems, unordered, and chaotic systems. And within ordered systems, you've got simple and complicated, i.e., you can trace the causal effect. If you do this, if this happens, you do this, this is the result every time. Complicated systems, you need a bit of analysis and experience to work out the cause-effect relationship. Something like that, you can say, what is the purpose? And then build it for that purpose. But complex systems are different. Complex systems, you can't basically find the thread. You can't just say, when you press that, this is going to be the result. Because every complex system, and I would argue every human group, is a complex adaptive system, and it's unique in that moment of time. Your company, for example, is in a moment of time, and now there's new people. There's no other company in the world that is in your situation. So how the company is literally the result of the interactions of its members. It is a complex system, and how those members interact produces, in a sense, the purpose. The purpose sort of almost arises out of the interactions, because you can't basically say we are going to do. Well, you can,
but the adherence, like, there's like, that's the budget, the budget is we're going to do this thing. And then the actual, which is what you can compare to, is how the confluence of all these behaviors and people in this complex system actually behave relative to that plan, right? So you're baking some cookies, there's a recipe there, but the cookies are never going to be the exact recipe, even if there's an extra granular of salt or sand or sugar or something. It's a technical deviation from, you know, the words on the page. So it's never going to be a perfect overlap of those two circles, but then it just comes down to like, well, what's the extent to which these two circles overlap, and what's the extent to which there's a gap between them, and what's the nature of that gap, and how does that actually translate in this complex system to a furthering of that gap or a collapsing of the gap? You know what I mean?
That's great, Nick. I think that's right. I think you got a bit muddled, and I'm not an expert in this model at all, but I think that's exactly it. If you're saying that this is your purpose, does the interactions of those people match what you say your purpose is?
Right.
Not simply do they agree with it, but actually does the interaction manifestly produce the very thing that you say that you're there to produce?
Right.
Which actually reminds me of Bonhoeffer, if I can get theological again. A book that I've read 4 times, but I haven't really understood. It's Sanctorum Communio. It was his doctoral thesis. Dietrich Bonhoeffer, a German pastor in the 30s and 40s, was hanged by the Nazis. And anyway, his argument in there, I think, was basically to do with the church is that the church was not just a group of people who agree to a thing. It is, and it is actually, it requires that people encounter one another. And then the spirit, so to speak, is the thing that is there because of encounter. And so I think the...
Interesting.
It's exactly the case in business or a club or a group or even a family. It has to come from the actual encounter of human beings with one another.
Yeah, what's your company culture if it's just one person? It's just your personality, right? To your point, like the culture can only kind of exist in any meaningful way when there's more than one person involved, because it's going to be that, it's going to fill the space between those two people and how they interact, and it's going to flex and it's going to move, and it's never going to be sort of one set thing. It's going to be this spirit or whatever you want to call it, to draw this analogy into the kind of secular business, realm that we're talking about. It's the space between folks, and like, what does that space feel like, and how does that change over time? And, it's crazy because we all have our different biorhythms and we go through these different things where our parents die and you have this and that happening, and all those kinds of things affect those spaces. And it's like, I don't know, how much space does your body occupy? It's like, well, that's literally changing at every moment, right? Even if you zoom in on your temple and your vein on your temple is moving, well, that's changing the amount of space around your body that you're occupying. Or you take a deep breath and your chest expands, like those spaces are moving all the time. And if you're not conscious about how the complex system moves, then your culture can deteriorate very quickly. And I've seen it through acquisitions where two companies come together and there wasn't enough care taken on the space between those bodies, those massive sort of corporate bodies, and then the whole thing falls apart. You know what I'm saying? It's a very, it's a very interesting kind of analogy you just brought up.
No, exactly that. I mean, and people lose their sense of purpose of why they even matter. So purpose sort of goes away, and their connections go away. And why bother doing anything if you're not connected? If you're not in relationship to them towards some kind of purpose.
Well then the purpose collapses down from something that's others focused down to self focused. And then it's like, well, I just need to just keep this job, or I need to find something else that's going to feed my own need. So it's just so fragile. I mean, as you're talking about this, the thing I'm thinking about is like how fragile it all is. Like, if you're living in a great culture, in a blink of an eye, that can all change. If you're not, if you have a beautiful secret garden that you've built, in a blink of a season, that thing can be overrun with weeds if you're not careful about tending it properly. You know what I'm saying?
No, exactly. And that's the irony and paradox about relationship is that relationships need relationships to become better. You need to have the conversation. You need to say, listen, can we meet? Because I think you're really gorgeous and I want to meet.
Right.
Or you need to say, listen, I haven't got time, or hey, let's do this, and you need to talk about it. And these five dimensions, and there's actually a whole survey mechanism. The Relationships Foundation in the UK has a way of surveying, so you can actually assess the relationship. And the interesting thing is, you're not assessing each other. You're both saying, does this relationship have, so there's a sense of psychological distance from the relationship. You're saying, do we contact?
He's not in it then. Yeah,
you're not basically saying, you don't meet me enough. I'm saying there's,
we're talking about the space between us, kind of.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And that enables a slightly less like emotionally laden. This discussion, you can say, oh, I thought that was a lot. I mean, because you're talking about the same empirical reality. One person thinks it's a lot, one person thinks it's a little, and you can find that out through survey. Do we meet a lot? Do we meet a little? You think, oh, you think that's a lot? I think that's hardly anything.
Right.
Oh, and you want even more? Man, I'm struggling to give you that.
So interesting.
And so, yeah, it's incredibly, it's very powerful. I mean, the model I've used in my own life is the reason why we didn't move off the street when we were looking to buy.
Interesting.
We were immediately able to buy the place. But I knew that if we move around the corner, then those daily encounters saying, hey, do you want to come over for pizza? Or, hey, let me help you with the snow there. Just because I've moved like 50 feet around the corner, the proximity changes. And now they're one of many other people. I've got to find my calendar and remember to schedule to go and see them. But just because I moved. And so these domains of understanding of contact and time, to me, have an enormous explanatory power for what we experience in relationships.
Right.
And real insight for how to make changes in relationship and make decisions about them.
Totally fascinating. People can find you on LinkedIn. Is that the best way to get in touch with you?
Yep, that's the best way. I did write a blog, actually. I did 30 days of exploring this framework, just looking, picking one thing a day to reflect on. It was 10 years ago, and I've barely written a blog since, but that's at simondgfowler.com.
Cool, your magnum opus on a blog. I love it.
Yeah.
Well,
I would rewrite it all now, but LinkedIn is.
Well, very good, man. Thank you so much for joining us. Until next time.
Thank you.
Thank you.